begin. And go back to the sharing of the screen. Yes, I know the participants can now see your application. Go away. Right, now there's just a very silly picture on the front. This is a man who was a DHL delivery man, and he just looked so much like the Old Testament or the version of God that we're used to, that I got him to pose for me as an idea that God is so unpopular nowadays, he's reduced to doing DHL deliveries, but it just made me laugh, and he seemed a really nice guy. But we're talking today about jealousy. And literally, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, because things do not go right for a lot of people in Genesis. But I would like to start with something about circumcision, because I was talking to my Jewish friend Adam, who's a fellow Kabbalist, about this. And he came up with the idea, and I rather like this idea, that circumcision might not have been intended at the very start to be something which was done as a baby. When Adam, I mean, that's a ghastly picture there of Abraham cutting his foreskin off from an ancient Bible. But the point of a blood ritual for a man or for a woman, it's a ritual of going to adulthood. It's an initiation. And I can absolutely understand the logic of making circumcision something that is as painless as possible and do it as early as possible to get the thing over. But for Abraham and for Moses and for most of the people in Genesis, it was a ritual that was done on puberty. And Joseph Campbell is very firm on this, which is that unless you have a ritual that takes you to manhood or womanhood, you won't grow up. There has to be a loss, there has to be an aspect of suffering, because if you don't learn how helpless you are and what it's like to hurt, or what it's like to commit yourself to some form of ritual that will hurt, that is symbolic of your growing up, you can stay a child because you won't understand the nature of pain. And I actually think that that's really an important aspect to consider about circumcision. Also, it was probably a replacement for human sacrifice. Necessary suffering, something that Richard Rohr talks about, is basically that we have to get onto the cross in order for the resurrection. We have to know what pain is like to be able to let go, let God, and allow the Holy to come into our lives. Otherwise, we want to control everything all the time. Now, Richard Rohr used to lead men's initiation rituals in the desert. He would take men into the desert for 5 days. And he was absolutely fascinated about how the ones who would agree to go off for 24 hours all on their own with just water would come back changed, whereas the ones who didn't want to do that did not change. There's something about a ritual of initiation which is really important. And of course, women have it automatically with the coming of menstruation. We have that ritual of blood. And in the ancient days, they used to have what we now call the red tent. We don't know how prevalent it was, but the women were taken into an all-female environment for up to 14 days in a month and taught the mysteries of the feminine. So for the women, it was a really, really important time. When I started menstruation, my mother just handed me some pads, said it was called the curse, and never thought any more about it. And that's what happens to most women today. But these rituals of blood and rituals of coming into adulthood are so important. In Japan, there's a ritual called the release of the honourable soldier. And anyone who has served in a war situation, when they come home, they have to go through a ritual to release them from being the soldier, to allow them to come back into civilian life. And the ritual involves honouring what they've done, weeping with them for what they have had to do, and kind of rebuilding them, reclothing them, to say that time of war is over and this is a new start in life. So it's completely changed my view on circumcision. I think it's probably a very important thing, and probably, I'm not going to say should, it might be a lot more helpful if we didn't do it at birth, but it was something that young men had to go through to understand this ancient law. Joseph Campbell says one of the reasons why we have things like people rioting on Saturday nights, throwing bottles, or the traditional thing of young men stealing a car and setting fire to it, is because they have not been sent out to the desert to kill their own lion. They haven't been entrusted by the tribe to go out on their own and do some brave act which could lose their life. And we still need these kind of things nowadays, because we are living in a society that really has refused to grow up. We don't acknowledge our pain. We don't sit with it. The Jewish faith also does something called sitting shiva. When somebody dies, you're expected to sit and grieve for 7 days, and people are supposed to come and sit and grieve with you and tear their clothes. And that's part of the going right down into the depth instead of covering it up. And again, when somebody's got COVID, they're posting on social media, what's the box set I can watch? How do I distract myself from this? But I know from my own healing that if you're experiencing pain and you're in a really, really difficult situation, you've got to sit with it. You've got to find out what it needs to teach you. It is extremely important that we do that. You'll notice in the next slide that there's a little spider's web at the bottom, and that's to remind me that I need to go to my notes because there's stuff I want to tell you that I haven't memorised. So that's what the spider is. And I want to talk a little bit about the women. And before we get outraged, because we do, about how women are spoke about in the Midrash and the Talmud and the commentaries, we have to remember a couple of things. Women's liberation is still relatively new. Women were generally thought of as possessions in ancient days. The Jewish world was actually much more liberated than the Greek and the Roman world, but the Greek and the Roman world won. A Jewish woman, for example, could own property, and a Jewish woman could be a president of a synagogue back in biblical days. And we're going to be talking about Shekinah and the Friday night service, and you have homework to do with the Sabbath Eve service, to tell you about how the woman could be reviewed as deeply sacred, deeply powerful in the Jewish faith in those days. But we also have to remember that the average scribe, now a scribe is someone who copies, he's not a creator. So a scribe is very much on the end of the nerd aspect. And scribes are not generally Brad Pitt lookalikes. They're generally guys who don't necessarily manage to get women. And I think it's important to look at that psychology as well. But certainly the Midrash, which is one of the commentaries, talks about women as having four main traits, with three more intrinsically feminine traits, which are all negative. So we're greedy, eavesdroppers, slothful, envious, talkative, scratchers, stealers, and gadding about. So it's actually four more, I'll have to amend that. And the evidence of these eight sins in the commentary are Eve was greedy, Genesis 3:6, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat. Sarah was an eavesdropper, Genesis 18:10, and Sarah heard in the tent door. Sarah was also slothful. Genesis 18:6, Abram says to her, make ready quickly 3 measures of fine meal. I don't think that one's proven myself, but still. Sarah was a scratcher, and that's actually an error. In Genesis 16:5, it's often translated as, my scratch be upon thee. But that comes from a rabbinical interpretation of the Hebrew word hamak, which is wrong, being derived from himis, to scratch. And it's also one of those words where you change the vowel, you change the meaning. So a more accurate translation might be, my wrong be upon thee, or my suffering be upon me, which is basically Sarah saying it's your fault. Rachel is said to be envious, Genesis 31, and it does say Rachel envied her sister because Leah was fertile and Rachel wasn't, and prone to steal, Genesis 31:19. Rachel stole the idols. And Dinah, Leah's daughter, who we'll talk about next week, was a gadabout, Genesis 34:1. And Dinah went out to see the daughters of the land. And Miriam, Numbers 12:1, Miriam spoke against Moses. So Miriam was talkative. Now, it's fair to say that the commentaries generally make a huge amount of the virtues of the women as good wives or mothers, but that's it. But that's how it was then. They seek meaning in the text in ways that can be really heartwarming and sometimes really perturbing to our modern eyes. And they also gloss over or excuse some of the women's problems. And they say, for example, that the barrenness that broke their hearts occurred so that their husbands might derive pleasure from them, for when a woman is with child, she is disfigured and lacks grace. For thus, that's heartbreaking. And a parallel passage in Midrash at this point says, as soon as Sarah conceived, her good looks faded. And we still have this in the modern world, don't we? A woman is valued by her sexuality and her beauty and her figure. So we haven't actually changed that much, but it's still something that we need to understand that they were very different from us back then. So our stories in Genesis really start to repeat now. There's so much evidence of the belief in karma. Let's start out with Abraham. He said when Sarah has died, and he wants a wife for Isaac, and he sends his oldest servant to find to where he was born, back into the tribe to find Isaac a wife. And we believe, it doesn't say, that that servant was probably Eliezer, who was Abraham's steward. And before Abraham had children, he was saying to God, well, Eliezer will be my heir. And God was saying no, or the Lord was saying no, you will have children of your own loins. So I suspect it was Eliezer. And what a man. He must have been quite magnificent, really. At one point he thinks he's going to be the heir, and then he's sent off to find a wife for the true heir. But it's interesting that Abraham is absolutely clear that he wants a wife for Isaac from the tribe. This is an interesting parallel with Abraham taking Lot out of the tribe, even though the Lord told him clearly not to. And there's a couple of references in Genesis to putting your hand under my thigh or wounding your thigh. And most people just go over it. But it's really interesting because that's how they took an oath in the Hebrew custom. You would put your hand under the thigh. And it had a symbolic purpose. In both cases, when it happens as a request, this is Jacob when he's dying of Joseph and Abraham, they always deal with family matters. They're always essential. And it was supposed to be the source of posterity. Well, of course, down there are your balls, your testicles. So that's where the reproduction thing is. So it's the loins. So under the thigh could be a euphemism for on the loins or even on the testicles. And there are two reasons apparently why someone would take an oath like this. Firstly, Abraham had been promised a seed by God, and this covenantal blessing was passed on to son and grandson. And so he was making Eliezer swear on the seed of Abraham that he would find a suitable wife. And of course, Abraham had been circumcised as a sign of the covenant. Now, our custom would be to swear on the Bible, but the Hebrew custom is to swear on circumcision, the mark of God's covenant. So the idea of swearing on your loins is found in other cultures as well. And strangely, the English word testify comes from exactly the same root as testicle. And it's fascinating, isn't it? And in Jewish tradition, there's also a different interpretation. According to Rabbi Ibn Ezra, the phrase under the thigh literally means that for someone to allow his hand to be sat on was a sign of submission to authority. And if that's the symbolism, then that's what Joseph was doing by showing his obedience to his father by putting his hand under Jacob's thigh. Abraham's servant also kept his oath. He not only obeyed Abraham's instructions, he also prayed to Abraham's God for help. And in the end, God pretty miraculously provided Rebekah as Isaac's wife. So Eliezer, let's call him Eliezer, though we don't know this, he's a very wise man. He says to God, show me the woman who will not only offer me drink if I sit by a well looking thirsty, but will offer my animals drink. And that's a Jewish mitzvah, which is that we must be kind to animals. And a woman who was kind to animals was thought to be a virtuous woman. And so he goes and he finds Rebecca at the well and he selects her because she says, I will give your camels water also. Now, Rebecca's really interesting because she shows developments. The whole idea of these women's stories, and I go into this in great depth in my book, A Woman's Worth, and I've put a link, a picture of that at the very end in case you want to follow on, because it was more than 20 years of research into this and I was fascinated by it. Rebecca does show some growth, but she's like all of us, excuse me, in that it's two steps forward and one step back. Rebecca is asked by her father Laban whether she wants to go with Eliezer. Now, this is liberation of the highest front. She is respected enough to have her opinion taken, because in those days, a woman had no right to choose her husband. It was chosen for her. And Rebecca said, I will go. So Eliezer takes her back, and Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent and took her, and she became his wife, and he loved her. And Isaac was comforted. Now, this is four levels. This is another lovely little hidden view of these four levels that we look at, literal, allegorical, metaphysical and mystical. He took her, i.e. had sex with her, that's physical. He married her, which was he cleaved him unto her, as it says in Genesis with Adam and Eve. They cleaved themselves unto each other, which is like, it's almost like grafting, cleaving. It is like grafting. You graft an apple tree onto a stronger root. So the cleaving is the idea that the two psychologically together are much stronger. He loved her, which is the spiritual aspect. They were able to work together in worship. And he was comforted because the divine mother came back to their tent because of the feminine returning. Now, this is Shekinah, and historical accounts of religious practice usually focus on the services at the temple, synagogue, and church, but not a lot is written about the simple everyday worship and ritual in the home. And in Judaism, worship in the home is paramount. It's really important. The whole of the way an Orthodox Jew lives is in service to the law and in service to the Holy One. We've all heard of the Jewish Sabbath Eve service. There's also the closing of the Sabbath and other home rituals. But most of the important spiritual rituals that would have concerned women in biblical days were unclean subjects in Jewish law because they were about menstruation and they were not publicly debated by men, which means they were not written down because the women weren't scribes. The women only passed this knowledge down in the oral tradition. But time-honored rituals handed down mother to daughter, grandmother to daughter, and villager to villager were all about fertility, lactation, childcare, dealing with disease, menstruation, birth, death. And the women dealt with birth and death. It was a woman who brought you into the world and it was a woman who laid you out when you died. And quite often it's possible the men didn't even know about them. In fact, some of the rituals might have been prevented by the priests if they'd known about them. For example, a herb to stop pregnancy in a woman who was already wounded by repeated childbirth would not have been tolerated openly in a society that believed that one of the greatest commandments was to be fruitful and multiply. Instead, they would have been given secretly and with a compassion, because the greatest teaching from the Talmud is loving kindness is greater even than truth. And that means that loving kindness is greater even than law. Nowadays, of course, much of what the women did in those days with the herbs and the salves that they made is known as medicine. And with the advent of science, such drugs can be manufactured and the origins are often unfortunately derided as alternative medicine. And we forget, for example, that our modern aspirin is derived from the bark of the willow tree. And actually, if you can chew the bark of a willow, it will give you the same effect as an aspirin, but without the possible stomach side effects, because they refined it so that aspirin can be sometimes toxic to a weak stomach. But the original herb, the original tree bark, didn't do that. And the women had a knowledge of herbs and rituals, and they really weren't enough above invoking magic if the need arose. And we'll talk about Rachel and Leah, about the mandrake root for fertility. But they used henbane and hollyhock for pain. They used poppy syrup, which is the forerunner of morphine or heroin. And there is a line in the Talmud about how a man went to a village to ask for a rabbi. And when the rabbi wasn't there, he said, then take me to the carpenter, because the carpenter was second in rank in the village to the rabbi. And there is some tradition that the carpenter was also the surgeon, because he knew how to bevel wood and he knew how to handle tools. And if somebody needed an amputation, it would be the carpenter who did it. So the carpenter's wife was quite frequently a herbalist. She would certainly have known how to make opium syrup, which today we'd call morphine. And carob was used for diarrhea. Elecampane root could bring up phlegm, helped with relaxation and sleep. Hyssop salved coughs. Hyssop flowers mixed with goldenrod formed a useful damp poultice for burns. Ergot could start or increase labour. Mistletoe, tansy and chrysanthemum had powerful and extremely dangerous abortive powers. They had to be used by an expert, and they were only used when the mother's life was in danger. Strangleweed was used as a contraceptive, dried, crushed and boiled in water. And Proverbs says quite clearly, Proverbs is one of the wisdom texts of the Hebrew Testament and has so many references to wisdom as the feminine. It says, forsake not the law of thy mother. And Ezekiel, the Lord reminds Israel of the importance of circumcision. And what's interesting is that when it was circumcision as a baby, which happened very, very swiftly, All the work of cutting the baby's umbilical cord, washing, salting and swaddling the child, and the circumcision was done by the women. And there's evidence of that in Exodus 4:25, because Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son. That's Moses' wife. So that's a whole load of background about the divine feminine and the women in those days. And I love this work. It absolutely fascinates me, I have to admit that. So Shekinah, which means dwelling, it's the dwelling place of God in the world. It's the physical aspect. It's the presence of the divine. Oh, there's a question. Let me just... I'll have to come back to that in a minute. I will stop for a minute after I've done that bit, after I've done the next page. And it resides in the heart of God and in the soul of the feminine. I've put a woman there, but if there is no woman available for the Sabbath Eve service, a man may do it using the feminine aspects within himself. And Shekinah is placed at the base of Atzilut. My cursor could show you Atzilut there. It's here. It's the place known as Adonai Shekinah. And it's also in Christianity the place of the Messiah. And so it's the feminine aspect residing in a male and in a woman. And at that level, there is no gender anyway. So we have both of those aspects within us. And it's that part of the divine that gives birth to souls into the world. And that's part, the part that receives them back into the heavens of death. And from the Zohar in the 2nd or 3rd, 13th century, we don't know when it was written. We know that... it's said to be channeled to a man called Moses de Leon in the 13th century from a 2nd century rabbi. But it may be, it may not be, and we'll never ever know. But it says quite clearly that a man is not complete until he's married, for the Shekinah does not leave the home as long as his wife is here. And the Shekinah only comes into a man's home when he marries. That's when the divine feminine aspect will come to complete the union. And as it says here, as we learnt from the verse, Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother. And they say that the lamp was kindled again because Shekinah came into the home. And Rebecca did the ancient rituals of lighting the candles for the Sabbath Eve. And the image there shows the woman putting her hands over her eyes. And you're going to get homework of doing the Sabbath when we've finished. And how a woman does this, I'll stop the screen share now and show you how it's done. Okay, so you can see me again, and I'll have a look at the chat in a second. Oh, Bill, you still got your mic on, somebody was saying. Right. The woman puts her hands round the candles. Hang on. If I turn the computer round, you can see in the corner over there, I've got two candles. Let me see if I can angle it. I always light a couple of candles for this. So the woman will go, she will light the candles, and she will put her hands around them once, twice, three times, and then she puts her hands over her eyes. And that's the four worlds. Because what she is doing is she has become the bride of the Sabbath. She is the physical representation of Shekinah. So she is going, absolute, divine world, come. Berea, spiritual world, come. Yetzirah, psychological world, come. And ground yourself in me. So it's a beautiful and ancient tradition. I'm going to send you the words so you can do it at home as your homework. Because even if you just do the first bit with the old prayer, which my mother-in-law used to say, and which I find really beautiful, and I'll send to you, there is a shift in you. You do it at sunset on a Friday, and both Bill and Don and any other men listening can do it from your feminine aspect. You'll still feel it. Okay, so we'll have a brief pause. Any thoughts, comments, questions?
On the last bit, let's grab it. Got my prayer book out. See if I can get it fast. Hold on. Here we are. Part of these episodes, this is what we read. I'll read it in the English. There's this lovely chorus, Now, come, my friend, to greet the bride, to welcome him the Sabbath Eve. Observe, remember one command. God made us hear a single phrase. For he is one, his name is one, in fame, in glory, and in praise. Come, my friend, to greet the bride, to welcome it in the Sabbath Eve. To greet the Sabbath, let us join, for from our endless blessings pour. First of all, creation willed, the final act, thought long before. Come, my friend, to greet the bride, to welcome in the Sabbath Eve. Arouse yourself, arouse yourself. Your light has come, arise and shine. Awake, awake, and pour out song, God's glory greets us at this time. Come, my friend, to greet the bride, to welcome in the Sabbath Eve. Come in peace, and come in joy. God your husband, you his pride. Among the faithful chosen people, come, my bride, come, my bride. Come, my friends, to greet the bride, to welcome in the Sabbath Eve.
Thank you. You see, there was great honour for the feminine, and it has been lost in the patriarchal systems. But it's nice to know it was there, and it's nice to know that it is still here, and it is absolutely accessible. Yes, thank you, Bill. Any more questions, thoughts? No? Okay, we'll go back to the screen share then and move on. Where are we? Here we are. Good. So let's talk about Rebecca. Rebecca, wife of Isaac, is barren, just like Sarah was. But there's a little bit of progress here, because instead of just waiting, Isaac prays to the Lord for his wife, and the Lord grants his prayer. Now, I don't know whether Abraham prayed to the Lord or to El Hai Shaddai. It doesn't say he did. It does clearly say that Isaac prayed. And when Rebecca conceives, she conceives twins, and she can feel them fighting in her womb, and she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, this is good because it means she has a direct relationship with the Holy One. And the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. This is Esau and Jacob. And two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels, and the elder shall serve the younger. Now, this is the key to the Rebecca story. The Lord has told her that the elder shall serve the younger. That is the destiny. So the boys grow up. Esau is a cunning hunter. He's a hairy man, a man of the field. And Jacob is a plain man who dwells in tents. And Isaac was really fond of Esau because Esau brought him back venison, but Rebekah adored Jacob. And Esau sells Jacob his birthright, which is the right to be the eldest son, to be the heir of the tribe. Because Esau comes back from hunting and he's tired, and Jacob is cooking, and Jacob has food, and Esau says, oh, I want some food. And basically Jacob says to him, you can have some food if you'll give me your birthright. And Esau goes, right, whatever, I'll have the food. And Esau is a simple animal man. He doesn't think about it. So we've got a pattern evolving here that Jacob is fully intending to be the leader. He has been groomed, if you like, by Rebekah, that he believes that he is the one who has the birthright. And there's a little aside here. I'm not going to read all of that out to you. You can read it yourselves later. But you remember Sarah and Abraham and Pharaoh and Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, and how Abraham said that Sarah was his sister. Well, guess what? There's a famine in the land, and Isaac and Rebekah head south, and exactly the same thing happens. And the king's called Abimelech again. So I really couldn't tell you whether or not this is actually meant to be the story of Rebekah and Isaac, or whether it's just a repeat that somebody put in. However, it doesn't go as far, so it may well be an example of learning in karma, because in this time, Abimelech sees Isaac sporting, well, spooning, kissing, having a cuddle with Rebekah, and realizes that she's his wife before taking her, before doing anything bad, and he tells Isaac off. Why did you say she's my sister? What have you done to me? One of the people might likely have lain with your wife, and you would have been brought guilt upon us. And what's really interesting is you see again and again in all these stories that the outsider, the one from outside of the tribe, is quite often the one with integrity. We see this more in the prophets than we do in the Torah. But quite nearly always, the one outside the tribe will demonstrate integrity to the tribe. But let's go back to the plot. Isaac decides he's very old and he's gone blind. Whether that's a psychological or spiritual state, we don't know. He's preferring Esau because he got good food from him to Jacob, who was the priestly class, was possibly a reference to symbolic blindness, but he must have been dim in the eyes because of the trick that was paid for him. Now, Rebekah decides to take things into her own hands to do God's will for him. Now, this is a lack of trust, but some people, quite validly point of view, say that she's helping God. But the outcome does not really give much evidence of that, but I'm going to leave it up to you to decide. She says to Jacob, go and get your father to bless you. And Jacob says, well, he's never going to bless me because I'm a smooth-skinned man and Esau is a hairy man. So Rebekah encourages him to dress up in animal skins. So, and there's the picture of Isaac with his hand on Jacob's, mistaking him for Esau. And his mother says to him, upon me be the curse of your deception, my son, only obey my voice. So Jacob does what his mother bids him. Let's have a quick look here at the three trees of life. It's a little bit complicated, but we're talking with the patriarchs and matriarchs about the lower kite, it's called, of the tree of life here. And I've put the women on the tree. It may not be accurate, but it's the best I could do. And here also are the Ten Commandments. So we're working with not coveting, not envying, not telling lies or deceiving people, not stealing, and not committing adultery. And these are the aspects that these people are working with to show us cause and effect when we break these commandments. And I know the commandments haven't been given, but the story is that the Torah was written down at or after the time of Moses when the commandments were given. Then it's quite easy to have hindsight. So Rebecca stands at the place of the ego, which is do not bear false witness, do not deceive the other. Leah is at do not steal, for reasons that will become obvious, and Rachel is at do not commit adultery, also for reasons of which will become obvious. And she's also at Netzach, because Netzach is about creativity and beauty and sexuality, and Rachel is Rachel the Beautiful. You might want to have a look at those a bit later, but you really could spend hours looking at these if you know understand them. However, four levels of interpretation of what Rebecca and Jacob do. Literally, she does what she thinks to be has to be done. She either doesn't trust God or she thinks she's in helping God. Allegorically, it's cause and effect, and we'll see how that works out. It does kick karma into the flow. The karma is about to happen. And metaphysically, how you feel about the story is important, because if you're approving of Rebecca's action, well, you may be right, but it does mean that you're a little bit of a control freak. You're not going to let God sort it out for you. And the older that I get, the more I know that you literally pray, ask, and let go. Because if you do it your way, there will be consequences. It's fine to have a guiding hand on the rein, but do not act deceitfully or even impulsively for the end you desire, because you will go from Yesod. You will not go from Tiferet where you're in direct contact with the divine. And the mystical aspect shows that there is evolution. Isaac's interceded. Rebecca talks to the divine, and Jacob might not have become Israel, which is coming along later, had he not had to take his own hero's journey, because Jacob is kicked out because of this action. And the hero's journey is so important for initiation. So what happens is Esau's furious. He threatens to kill Jacob. Isaac sends Jacob away, telling him to travel to Rebekah's relatives and find a wife from among the tribe again. And Rebekah loses the respect of her eldest son. She probably loses the respect of her husband, and she loses her beloved son. So the consequences of Rebekah would indicate for me that this was not God's plan, and that God might have had another way of doing it. Whether or not that's the case, it's an incredibly valuable story for us to learn that choice has consequence. And it's also interesting, Midrash says about Rebecca, her father was a rogue, her brother was a rogue, the people of her town were rogues. This righteous woman who came forth among them might well be compared to a lily among thorns. Personally, I think she was a rogue, but that's just my opinion. But without her actions, other things, the story would not have been so magnificent. So who knows? Who knows? The hero's journey. Jacob goes out and goes towards the country of Haran. And this is where he starts having his mystical experiences. And this is the origin of what we call Jacob's ladder, the tree of life, the ladder there on the right-hand side. And there's Blake's picture of it on the left. And this ladder reached up to heaven, and it circles in the diagram that Blake didn't know about DNA. But actually, DNA is perfectly expressed in that diagram of Blake's and in Jacob's ladder. So it's fascinating how these things work out. And he saw this ladder, and he beheld the angels of God ascending and descending on it, and he began to understand mystical truths. He travels back to the homeland of Laban, who was Rebecca's brother, that's right. He has two daughters, Leah and Rachel. Leah had either tender or weak eyes, but there was some issue around Leah's eyes, and Rachel was lovely and beautiful. And Rachel was always known as Rachel the Beautiful. Now, Jacob fell head over heels for Rachel. I'll take that back for the moment. Head over heels, and wanted to marry her. And Laban said to him, if you work for me, if effectively in slavery for 7 years. And in the ancient days, you could only have a slave for 7 years because the Jewish Sabbath meant that all debts were forgiven and all slaves were freed. So in fact, in those days, it was almost like an apprenticeship. And if you had a child, one child too many that you couldn't afford to raise, you would put a child into slavery because they'd be looked after and fed and they would learn a skill. They might be enslaved to a carpenter, for example, and they'd learn that skill. And after 7 years, they would be free. So it wasn't as bad as we think slavery was in those days. You were obliged to free every slave every 7 years. So Jacob goes into work for Laban, and he works for 7 years, and he still loves Rachel. Be aware that in those days, even though nowadays modern movies tend to assume that the lovers will kiss, they really were kept apart from each other. Purity was very, very important. So he wouldn't have got to know Rachel as well as you might have done if you were courting somebody in the modern age. And after the seventh year, he says he's allowed to marry Rachel. And then he marries Leah. So how does that happen? Well, firstly, a bride was very deeply veiled. And secondly, there are all sorts of commentaries about this, about how Rachel knew that Leah would never marry and she wasn't ready to get married, and she was willing to give Leah to Jacob as long as he married her as well. And Leah was keen to marry Jacob, and Jacob was worried that Laban might deceive him, so he gave Rachel a sign that she would show to him at the point of the wedding so he would know it was truly her. And Rachel told Leah the sign, so Leah gave Jacob the sign. We don't know, but whatever it is, the story says that basically he didn't discover that it was Leah until they were married. And then he goes to Laban and says, "Oi, what have you done? No, I was going to marry Rachel." And Laban, who is a real trickster, says, "Well, work for me for another 7 years and you can have Rachel, and you can have Rachel pretty much now if you agree to work for me for the other 7 years. But give Leah her 7 days." And that's significant, which is have sex with Leah. Make Leah your wife, because if he'd married Rachel again immediately, polygamy was perfectly acceptable in those days, then he probably never would have had sex with Leah. Well, we don't know. But anyway, during that week, Leah becomes pregnant. And it says in the Bible, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So we have Leah the thief, because she does steal Jacob. And we have Rachel the adulteress for several reasons, because nothing ever says that Rachel loved Jacob. Nothing even implies that Rachel loved Jacob, even though he loved her. And she was the second wife, and that threesome didn't work. And the definition of adultery is quite simple. It's to add something that poisons. You can actually have three people in a relationship which isn't adulterous because it actually helps the relationship. We don't believe much of that in the modern world, but it can happen. But in this case, it wasn't working. When Rachel saw she had no children and Leah was popping them out right, left and centre, she said to Jacob, "Give me children or I'll die." And Jacob was angry with her. And he said, "Am I in God's stead who's withheld you the fruit of the womb?" So compare Jacob with Isaac there. That's interesting. Something's not going right. There's all sorts of clues in all the stories of the marriages in the Bible about whether things are going right. And Rachel is obviously mad as a hatter and jealous as everything. And this marriage isn't working, because when she goes to Jacob, he's not going to talk to God for her. So Rachel copies Sarah and gives Jacob her maid Bilhah to bear children on Rachel's behalf. And Bilhah either agrees or has no choice. She'll be a slave. And Leah, having said that, says Leah's stopped having children by that point. She gives Zilpah, her maid, to Jacob. So Jacob's having a fine old time with four wives. And they continue to have children, but Rachel continues to be barren. Now, the other reason she could be thought of as adulteress is because she works with magic. Reuben, Leah's eldest son, goes into the fields and finds mandrakes. If you ever watched the Harry Potter movies or read the books, you'll know that a mandrake root can look like a baby. So by the doctrine, is it the doctrine of signatures, that plants quite often look like the aspects in us that they can heal? The mandrake is a powerful fertility medicine. So Rachel says to Leah, can I have the mandrakes? And Leah says, well, you've taken my husband, because obviously if she's not doesn't appear to be fertile anymore, Jacob isn't sleeping with her. Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? And Rachel says, well, you can have him tonight. There's quite a dynamic going on in this family, if I can have the mandrakes. So Jacob comes to the field and Leah says, you must come to me tonight, for I've hired you with my son's mandrakes. Goodness knows what's going on. And he slept with her that night and she conceived again and had a fifth son. So the mandrakes don't work for Rachel, but they actually give Leah another son. So the magic wasn't working. And also later on, when Jacob leaves Laban, Rachel steals Laban's idols, his teraphim, which are idols for another god. And that's also indicative of adultery, because she's working with all the other aspects to try and conceive a child. Now, the women did do that, because in those days you could divorce your wife for infertility, just like that. So it was incredibly important for them to have children. So they did anything they could, because their survival was at stake. So Leah has six sons and one daughter. Rachel eventually has two sons, and the other children for the 12 tribes of Israel come from Bilhah and Zilpah. And eventually God remembers Rachel. Now it's God, Elohim, remembering Rachel. The Lord doesn't. And God hearkens to her and opens her womb, and she has a son, which is Joseph, which means he will add. And she says immediately, the Lord will give me another son. Which is interesting. One is not enough. She definitely wants more. And that's her downfall. But we'll come back to that. There's another thing too, which is that Jacob wants to leave Laban by now. He's had quite enough of this trickster. He wants to be independent. He wants to move away with his family. And Laban isn't going to let him and wants him to stay. And Jacob sort of submits a bit and says, all right, well, if you give me the speckled sheep and speckled cows, which were not valued as much, I will stay. But then a series of, there's a picture there of how he did it. He got the animals to drink when they were in reproductive form by looking at staves in a river so that the light speckled through them, which the Bible says is why they had speckled offspring. Well, it's a magic. It is a magic. And the speckled ones breed magnificently, and the non-speckled ones of Laban's do not thrive. So this is Laban's karma, because he's trying to hold Joseph, Jacob against his will. And the angel of God, again, Elohim, comes back into this, saying, calling to Jacob and seeing that all the rams are now siring speckled and grizzled animals. I've seen that Laban is unfair to you, and I have done this for you. So on the other hand, did Jacob need to do the taking of the animals to the river for the speckles? Because God was going to do it for him. So that one, they worked together, and that's okay, because nobody's been harmed through it. But God was going to do it for him anyway. And this is an important lesson for us. God will help us. We shouldn't rush to help ourselves. And I am the God of Bethel, says Elohim, where you anointed the pillar, because when Jacob saw this vision of the angels, he poured oil on the stone and named the place Bethel, house of God. And he says to Jacob, you need to get out. Get out of this land and go back to the land of Abraham. I love this. And Jacob saw the face of Laban, and it was not as friendly as before. Well, no shit, Sherlock, if you'll pardon my phrase, because Laban was actually going to lose him. And Jacob walks, and Laban chases. And Laban comes upon them and says, one of you has stolen my idols. I want them back. And Rachel hides the idols under a camel saddle and sits on it. And she's menstruating at the time, so nobody can touch that. If a woman menstruating sits on a seat, a man could not touch it because he would have been made impure by touching the seat sat upon by the menstruating woman. So Rachel's theft is not discovered. However, the next phase is lovely. Rachel and Leah advise Jacob. It says that he takes advice from them. That's very good. We have more evolution here, more of people learning to work together. And Jacob goes to seek forgiveness from Esau. He's terrified. He thinks that Esau may kill him, but Esau forgives him and the brothers are reunited. Rachel then becomes pregnant again and she dies. The midwife said, "Fear not, you will have this son too," and she does, but she dies giving birth to Benjamin. She calls him son of my sorrow because she knows that she will die. But his father calls him Benjamin, son of my right hand. And although this is pretty much anathema to Orthodox Jewish folk, I always find it so interesting. Rachel is buried just outside what we now call Bethlehem. And her tomb is the place where people go for prayers around fertility, which is odd because she wasn't very fertile. And the famed red string, which is a Middle Eastern aspect of warding off the evil eye, which used to be tied to the wrist of a baby when it was born. The red string is wrapped around Rachel's tomb as a protection. And it just fascinates me that she was not happy, not particularly fertile, dies in childbirth, and we don't know if she even loved her husband, and yet she's held up as somebody who would heal us. She can only heal us by learning from her sorrow. We learn from Rachel's suffering. And then we return to the thigh thing, because next thing that happens to Jacob is he wrestles with an angel. Now, it's called a man, but as we've mentioned before, quite often a man is an angel. It depends on the Y text or the E text, whether it's translated, whether the Hebrew says man or malek, which is angel. And this says man, but it's fairly clearly an angel. And they're wrestling. They're wrestling and wrestling, and this is an angel of God. And this is evocative of the fact that when we are in spiritual travail, we do wrestle with God. We wrestle with the law, we wrestle with the teaching, and a true spiritual seeker will always wrestle. You go into the text, I need to understand this, I don't get this, what's going on here? What does it mean to me? So symbolically, that's Jacob's wrestling with the angel. And the angel, it says here, he could not prevail against him, but if this is the angel of God, it's much stronger than Jacob. So one of the commentaries on this is really rather beautiful about it, in that it says that when you are fighting a master in any form of proper martial arts, the spiritual master will always hold back, because they have an unfair advantage. However, and the controversy about the phrase could not overcome him comes from, I can't pronounce the Hebrew here, the phrase lo yakol is used in verses such as other verses in Genesis and Exodus to mean was unable, as in was not willing to. You know, was actually holding back. So it's pointless to quickly and pointlessly defeat any student because they won't learn. So the instructor is unable technically to defeat that opponent using the limited approach that they've adopted so the other can learn. And then there comes a point at which they have to make the other submit so they don't become arrogant with what they've learned. And apparently the general point of view among the rabbis was that this was the angel of God's way of saying, okay, I've let you wrestle with me, but now know my power. And he puts his hand in the hollow of Jacob's thigh, which goes out of joint, whether it's dislocated or not, we don't know. And then Jacob says, let me go. No, the angel says, let me go. And Jacob says, I won't let you go until you bless me. And the angel of God says, what's your name? He says, Jacob. And he says, no, your name shall no more be Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince you have power with God and with men and have prevailed. So there are two ways of translating Israel. Israel means God prevails. However, Kabbalists generally translate it as one who struggles with God. Coming back to this whole idea of the fact that it is a struggle to understand the will of the Holy One. And again, we're having this Elohim aspect again. It's not the Lord here. Elohim appears to Jacob again and says, your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel. So this is a repeat. So it might be the two texts repeating. And God says, I am El Shaddai. And this is the divine feminine again. Be fruitful and multiply, and a nation and a company of nations shall come from you. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you and your seed after you. Oh, and I was mistaken earlier. This is the point at which he pours oil on the rock and calls the place Bethel. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway. So what have we learnt from these stories? Well, we've learnt that the Bible teaches karma. We learnt that prayer works, that it's important to allow God to go about God's own business in God's own time. And wanting what the other has got is usually the starting point of error. Jacob wants what Esau's got. Rebecca wants for Jacob what Esau has got. Leah wants what Rachel's going to get. Rachel wants what Leah's got, which is fertility. And also theft. A definition of theft kabbalistically means that it also includes taking the humanity from somebody or taking the right to be its true self from somebody. So it's like taking a person or an animal like a thing. And we see a lot of that nowadays in the modern world. A human or an animal is a conscious, sentient being that deserves to be consulted on its fate in some way or other. So theft includes treating people like things. And of course, Bilhah and Zilpah, like Hagar, were treated like things. They weren't given a choice in the matter. That adultery is to add something to which poisons. And certainly, Rachel and Leah's relationship was poisonous. Using magic might work in the short term, but it won't bring long-term happiness. We don't know what else Rachel was doing or whether it was the teraphim or the idols that made her fertile, but the poor girl dies in childbirth, so she does not live a long and happy life. Also that God or the Lord still loves you, however bad or stupid you may be, because God is still talking with Jacob, who basically has been a liar and a thief and behaved quite badly in many ways. But that doesn't matter to God. God loves us and will help us to grow whatever. Also, something very important, which is don't believe a word I say. Your job is to wrestle with God yourself. If I can help you in any way, shape or form to do that, then that's marvellous. But your relationship with the Holy One is the only one that matters. You have to wrestle with God and you will not emerge unscathed. And just returning very briefly to the thigh, what's fascinating about this whole aspect of the angel of God and Jacob's thigh is that this refers either to the sciatic nerve or the tenderloin. We Philistines, we Gentiles, eat tenderloin of pork. Well, Jews don't eat pork anyway, but they certainly wouldn't eat the tenderloin of any animal, which is the muscle that goes exactly at that point in the loin. And most people call Jews, Christians, Islamic people, the people of the book, particularly the Jewish folk, but the Chinese don't. The Chinese call them the nation that do not eat the sinew, because the nation who do not eat the sinew. That's what they call Jewish people, because Jewish folk don't eat the sinew in honour of Jacob and in honour of Abraham. This isn't in any of the food laws, but it's come down through the oral tradition, and it's still, I gather, exactly what is brought. You just wouldn't eat that. It's many Jewish persons' way of recognising this aspect of working with God, of wrestling with the Holy One. Okay, so next time we're going to look at the scapegoats, Joseph and Dinah, the ones who were betrayed. In Joseph's case, it all comes good. In Dinah's case, it doesn't. And your homework is going to be invoking Shekinah. This needs to be done on Friday night, so hopefully you could do it at sunset tomorrow. Doesn't matter if you can't do it tomorrow, just please try it one day. And I'm going to send you the entire Sabbath Eve wording for the invoking of the Sabbath, so you can do it all yourself, you can do it with a partner, or you can just do the part which is done by the woman, which is the lighting of the candles. But if you want to do the whole thing, you need two candles, wine, water, bread and salt. And I shall send you the instructions and ask you to report back next week. And finally, if you do want to read any more, that's my book about the women of the Hebrew Testament. And I would be honoured if you wanted to read it. So there we are. And actually, it didn't overrun. That's quite scary. Thoughts, comments, questions, please. How was that? Anyone?
If there are no questions, just relate one incident from my life.
Yes.
Going back now, what, 60 years, but I had a polio jab which went wrong. Nobody knew at the time such what happened. But anyhow, I was pretty ill with it. And then I suffered a nervous exhaustion. And the firm asked me to move to another department at the time. They wanted me to do it. And I took it on. It's all a good thing. But I collapsed completely. And I was pretty low. And I suddenly found myself praying and saying to God, except thou bless me, I shall not let go of thee. And so God said, all right then, if you want to play at being Jacob, you better play at Jacob's fate. Next thing I knew, I had violent sciatica.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's fascinating. Thank you, Bill. That's amazing. Cool.
So be careful what you pray for.
Oh, yes. That's very true. Be careful of what you pray for. You may get it. The thing is, the Holy One knows your whole life's patterns and knows exactly what you need to grow. And you can ask for rest. You can certainly ask for a time of rest, but you've got to be very careful. I do know somebody who went on holiday, a skiing holiday, and he was having such a good time, he said, for two pins, I'd stay here for another 2 months. And that very day, he had a fall, broke his legs, and had to have two pins in them, and stayed in a hospital in that place for 2 months.
Wow.
You really have to watch what you're doing. And the more you get into this work, the more careful you have to be. For example, never, ever say, I'm sick and tired of this. Because you're invoking sickness and tiredness.
Mm.
I'll do this if it kills me. Don't say it. Please don't say it. You know, because actually, the more we work with the Holy One, the more our guardian angels and our spirit guides will listen to us and take us literally. Right. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, yes. Go on, Elise.
Just quickly. Why is... you might have already said this and I missed it. Why is invoking Shekinah for Fridays?
Oh, it's the Sabbath Eve. It's the Sabbath Eve is technically a Friday night to Saturday night. Friday night at sunset till the first star in the sky on Saturday night. And it's the day off. It's the holy day, the seventh day of the Holy One. So you invoke the bride of the Shekinah, or the bride of the Sabbath, to be the mother aspect to take care of you for that day.
Right, okay.
So it's making sacred the Sabbath. I will not work this day. And I don't always succeed, but my Sabbath is Saturday night till Sunday night. And I don't go on the internet. I don't go anywhere. I don't watch any violent movies, any violent TV. I actually say, I am stepping back and I am going to mother myself.
That's preparation. Yeah.
Yes, Don.
So it sounds like Saturday evening would work for me, as I'm working every Friday around sunset time.
Yeah, that'll be fine. Yeah, I've done it on Friday nights and Saturday nights. I usually do it on Friday, but if I can't do it on a Friday, the Holy One doesn't seem to hit me with lightning flashes or something if I do it on a Saturday night. But eventually, it's lovely to have the ritual of a Friday night, but the idea is take a day off, for God's sake. You know, but it's lovely to have this sacred ritual because it makes you feel that you have invoked, drawn some spirit down. It is an extraordinary feeling, so I really recommend you give it a go. Okay, anybody else? Yes, Bill.
So one other point, Jacob and Esau, why Jacob got the birthright. Remember, it stuck in my mind all these years of Rabbi explaining that when Esau asked Jacob for the pottage, the actual Hebrew translate did as "let me guzzle of the red pottage," and because his attitude was to guzzle, he was considered not fit to carry.
I think he was not fit. Yes, that makes sense. He was greedy.
That word "guzzle," which sort of spelt it out.
Yes. Good point, Sally.
Where Bill read the prayer from? He read a...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Bill, would you be kind enough to email me the details of that lovely prayer
that prayer is actually a holistic prayer from the school of Isaac Lerer. Solomon Alkoblitz wrote it. That would be in the 17th century.
Could you just type that out for me, Bill, and then I'll send the details on to everybody
else. I'll scan it here and send
lovely.
It to you.
That would be marvellous. Bless you.
It was great, Jay. We must select you. Lord, I made the mistake. And the other thing was, sorry to raise this, but session one, for some reason, I seem to have lost it.
I'll send it again.
Thank you.
Not a problem. All right, love. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tonight. God bless you.